Welcome back to Issues, Etc. 25 minutes of open lines ahead. Your questions, your comments. Feel free to give us a call, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Before the break, we heard from debate on both sides of the issue on the federal marriage amendment. We talked earlier with Amy White about the Missouri amendment that would also limit marriage to a man and a woman. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's start off talking with Jane, who calls from her car. Jane, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. We voted yesterday absentee, my husband and I did, in Jefferson County. And the amendment, you have to, you know, you read it, and we hope that we voted right. We voted yes. And then I took my grandson to the barbershop after that, and the barber was saying that he thought that it was worded that you would vote no to say yes. And I just wonder if anybody else had heard that.
I hate it when they do that, don't you?
I know. We kept... Because we were absentee, we could stand there and discuss it, because there were just the two of us in this room, and it was like, I don't know, I hope we did right.
Well, anyway, here's the official ballot, okay? And it says, it's proposed by the 92nd General Assembly. Shall the Missouri Constitution be amended that to be valid and recognized in this state, a marriage shall exist only between a man and a woman? That's the question, to which is required either a yes or a no answer. If you want the Missouri Constitution to be amended, you answer yes. If you want the Missouri Constitution to remain as it is, you answer no. If you want marriage to be defined between a man and a woman in the Missouri Constitution, you say yes. If you want the possibility of gay marriage a little sooner rather than later, you vote no. That's the text there. Actually, the last part there was just my extrapolation on the text. Very simple. If you want the Missouri Constitution to be amended to define marriage as a man and a woman, you vote yes. I'd like to hear from you on this issue, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Were you disappointed at the Senate's refusal to even consider this issue? To even consider the issue of a federal marriage amendment? And if you're disappointed, where does your disappointment lie? With the Senate in general? I mean, there are people who are fighting for this, really. But the fact that they could not get the 60, and then there's another part of the procedure that requires 67 votes in order to push this through on this procedural vote. The fact that they couldn't do that, what does it tell you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It is an election year, you know, and one-third of the U.S. Senate stands for election every 2 years. They go in six-year shifts, you know. 6 years is their term, and every year one-third of the Senate stands for election. Whereas with the House members, every 2 years, these guys have to fight for their seats. It changes the mindset of the Senate, too, a little bit. Do you think it had to do simply with this is an issue that's just simply going to divide my base, no matter who you are. I don't want to have to say anything about it. So if we can get away with saying nothing about it, we're not going to say anything about it, which is what happened in the end in the U.S. Senate. Or do you think it really is that if the Senate were quietly polled in the middle of the night, unofficially, they would actually be against a federal marriage amendment? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Do you think that his support will help or hurt this? The president has stood behind this. It took him a while to come out on it. Do you remember? He said all along, I believe that marriage should be between a man and a woman. And at first he said, I'm going to let the lawyers look this over. And then he said, we might have to codify it in some form. But he was still unwilling to commit himself. And then, several months ago, he said, I am in favor of a federal marriage amendment. And if it's passed the way it needs to go, I'm going to stand behind it all the way. Do you think that his support for this is helping or hurting a federal marriage amendment to define marriage as a man and a woman? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. To turn the coin over, is it helping or hurting him to be in favor of the federal marriage amendment? And to be willing to put himself on the line. I mean, every president's going to do this. And amending the Constitution is a huge thing. It's about as big a thing as this country can do. We talk about the big things being the election of our legislature, the appointment of judges, the election of presidents. In the grand scope of things, amending the Constitution is bigger. It has a broader impact. Do you think it's helping or hurting President Bush in his bid for re-election? It's Open Lines, Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin, and we are coming to you live this Thursday. It's the 15th of July. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Greg Kokel will join us here in about 15 minutes. He's president of Stand to Reason. We're going to be talking to him about hate crimes and hate speech. It's a related topic, of course. While we're waiting for your calls, our Issues, Etc. book of the month for July, Modern Fascism. We're going to be talking about hate speech and whether we can criminalize thought. That was one of the tenets of fascism, and that is overt thought control. When you found it among the Nazis or in Mussolini's Italy, overt thought control of the population. Now, they did it through crude forms like propaganda, some of which are still with us today. We're not talking about ray guns that will change your brain. Just the simple manipulation of the populace through the media. It's still with us today, isn't it? Is fascism still with us? You can find out by reading our Issues, Etc. book of the month for July. It's called Modern Fascism by a regular guest here on Issues, Etc., Dr. Gene Edward Veith. The book is $17.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order it from Concordia Publishing House. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org, and under the What's New section, you'll find information on the book. If you'd like to browse before you buy, Modern Fascism, our Issues, Etc. book of the month for July. Let's talk with Brad, who's calling from his car. Brad, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good afternoon. How are you doing today?
Doing well, Brad.
Hey, I'm appreciating your show today. It's a topic that's really kind of putting a wedge in this country, and it's kind of a shame that people are forgetting what God set things out to be. But you kind of touched on a point a little earlier on last hour about how we're going, can we tell people they're wrong, kind of along that line of thinking. And it kind of brought to mind that passage in James chapter 5, where it talks about how we should go to erring brother and try to show them what their wrong is, and if we can save them, it's really a great benefit to us and to them and to the kingdom of God. And just kind of a sad thing that people are forgetting those kind of principles that, you know, if it's okay for you, then it's right, and no one else come in and put their input in or tell you any different.
Brad, thank you very much for the call. Yeah, and I think he points out something that we should take note of. The mindset that has gripped the culture, we call it political correctness, but it's basically radical kind of laissez-faire, let everyone live and let live. It is not only among liberals, you also find it among libertarians too. Now, libertarians have that mindset, but they may be there economically. Conservative. But it's not just the culture, folks. This laissez-faire, live and let live, radical, you can't tell me that I'm wrong. And if you tell me that I'm wrong, you're attacking me, or you're trashing me, or if you tell me that I'm wrong, you're being hateful, you're being intolerant, it's mean, it's base. Just leave me alone. Leave me alone and let me do as I please. You know, in the culture, they'll say, leave the homosexuals alone and let them mind their own business. And the same thing is gripping the church. Just leave us alone, mind your own business. We'll do our thing over here, you do your thing over there. What do you do with a passage like James, where we are supposed to correct one another? In an age, in the culture and in the church, where the greatest sin you can commit in the culture and in the church is correcting someone. It's considered the greatest sin you can possibly commit, to tell someone that they're wrong. Maybe we should come up with a new name for it. My producer suggests libertarian Christianity. Libertarian Christianity. And I've thought about this earlier this afternoon. In the same way that, see, the kind of the libertarian mindset in the culture wants as little government as possible. I don't want anything telling me what to do. Minimum. I know we got to have some, but just absolutely minimum. And whatever we have is a necessary evil. In the church, it's applied to doctrine and the authority of God's word. Just as little doctrine as possible. I know we have to have some. I mean, come on. We got to have some, but we keep it to a minimum, an absolute minimum. Otherwise, it might infringe upon our laissez-faire lifestyle and practices. It's amazing how these things parallel one another. Roland is calling from Hoyleton, Illinois. Roland, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, you bet. Hello there.
Hello.
I've been listening to this, and it bothers me immensely. I think it's very damnable. And you think of Sodom and Gomorrah. They fell, and they fell hard. And another thing, I cannot understand how there can be any excitement in a marriage of two guys or two gals. It's just beyond my comprehension. I just had to express that. And where this country is going, it shouldn't even be an issue. It shouldn't be brought up. It should just be laid to rest and forgotten. You know, it's terrible.
Roland, thank you very much for the call. Well, you know, I think he raises two things. One, he finds it inconceivable that one would want to do this. Now, we could talk about that, but that is not the point. Because this isn't a question of preference. This isn't a question of whether I can imagine why a man would want to be married to another man. I can't. I can't put myself in their shoes, and I shouldn't have to. Right? Filling my own shoes is enough to worry about. This is not an issue of preference. This is not, I prefer women, and I can't imagine how a man could prefer another man, therefore that makes me intolerant. That's not what we're talking about. Now, of course, that's not what Roland is saying. But the issue is not preference. The issue is not sexual preference or even orientation. The issue is behavior. That's all the law can deal with. The state has no interest in who loves who. The state has no interest in who likes who, who's attracted to who. The state does have an interest in who marries who, because that's a behavior. Now, that distinction has been blurred by the debate, of course. The state's interest does not lie in who loves who likes who, who's attracted to who, but only in what they do about it and whether they can marry one another. Now, the other thing he raises there is that it's a sad thing we're even talking about this. That's true, but we do not choose the issues choose us. We do not choose the times in which we live and the debates in which we are going to engage. They choose us. If we could choose this debate, I'm with Roland. I wouldn't want to talk about this. If we could choose our debates and choose the issues that we have to fight about, then I'm with Roland. We should be able to just take it and lay it aside, right? We should be able to dispense with this and dismiss it out of hand. We don't get to choose that, either as Americans or as Christians. We do not get to choose the times in which we live. I say they choose us. God chooses them for us, we should more rightly say. And the battles which we are called to fight, we don't get to pick them. We are simply called to fight them. So is it a sad thing that we should even consider amending the Constitution, that we wouldn't have to think about putting the definition of marriage in the Constitution? Yes, it is a sad thing. It is a very sad thing that we should even have to consider it. But that point is really moot. If I could snap my fingers and make it go away, I would. If I could, with a wave of my hand, make the debate go away and everyone would suddenly agree, I would. But I can't. I've been wondering lately how much worse it can get. Because it seems as though not just society, but the church is being rocked by this debate. And it's a symptom of something bigger. This isn't just people arguing in the culture and in the church about marriage, or people arguing in the culture and the church about homosexuality. This is a symptom of a far greater problem. And believe it or not, folks, as big as the problem is in the culture is unredeemable. We shouldn't expect the culture to be able to have any answers for this, except making laws, which is all we can do there. But the church should know better. What saddens me is that there are Christians who, when they hear about a federal marriage amendment being debated in the Senate, their ears perk up and their eyes are wide open. But when they watch fellow Christians pursuing exactly the same path in the name of Christ, in the name of bringing Christ to the world, ho-hum. Or on smaller matters, Christians who are more concerned about what's going on in the culture than on the very same things that are going on in the church, or, well, they took prayer out of schools. Isn't that terrible? Yeah, it's terrible. They took God out of the pledge. Isn't that terrible? Yeah, it's pretty bad. Are you concerned that they took Jesus out of the sermon on Sunday? Are you concerned that your pastor on the 4th of July didn't preach Jesus? And then even when the 4th of July didn't come around the next Sunday, he still didn't preach Jesus? Or he may have mentioned Jesus, but never got to the cross? Never got to the message that Paul says is the message of salvation for everyone who believes. Does it concern you, pastor, wasn't so worried about salvation last Sunday? Now, in the eyes of the world, that looks like a small thing. Oh, those are just Christians quibbling over what they preach. Doctrinal minutia. It is, in fact, a greater tragedy every Sunday when a pastor fails to preach Christ and Him crucified than when an endless array of politicians recites the pledge with no God in it. It is a greater tragedy every Sunday when a pastor fails to preach the good news of Christ's perfect life, death, and resurrection for all sinners than if President Bush were to do handstands in favor of gay marriage. It's a bigger tragedy. It doesn't look like it in the eyes of the world, and I know it doesn't look like in our eyes sometimes either. But it does far more harm when a pastor omits the cross than when we omit prayer from school, the Ten Commandments from our judicial buildings. Far more harm. In one case, the culture might be harmed. And that's not a good thing. But in the other case, people are going to hell. And they're sitting in church thinking they're hearing the message of salvation when they're hearing everything but the message of salvation. Roy is calling from his car. Roy, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good afternoon, Pastor. I just couldn't help, and I was telling Jeff, I just couldn't help but think while you're talking about what the church, all the things the church is doing, and sitting by in this laissez-faire attitude. And if I look at the church I just left to become a LCMS member, I talked to my former pastor today, and he's fighting that battle every day. But I couldn't help but think, look at the battle we have just over the issue of justification. I cannot understand why some denominations can't see the justification issue, that we are saved by grace through faith alone in Christ. And it's not up to me as to what I do or the decision I make. So I think the church is fighting issues, and we have been fighting them forever. And this homosexuality, this gay marriage thing is just another issue that the church has to face.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Well, you know, it would be easy to immediately jump to say those nasty Roman Catholics who just can't seem to get the message of grace right. That we are justified, that is declared righteous by grace, by God's undeserved favor for us, through faith, which is simple trust in Christ's perfect life and death and resurrection. For Christ's sake alone, that is, Jesus did it all, you add nothing. It would be easy to jump to the Roman Catholics and say, look, for thousands of years they haven't been able to get that right. You know, I would rather deal with an honest Roman Catholic who differs with me and can actually tell me what he means when he uses the word justification, and most of them can tell you. I would rather deal with an honest Roman Catholic on that issue than with someone who says, justify what? Which is a lot of Christians. Or someone who says, yeah, I know what justification teaches, but it's just not that big of a deal. There are more important things to talk about, right? Or, if we overemphasize justification, I'd rather deal with an honest Roman Catholic who differs with me on what justification is, but he is still willing to say it's the thing we ought to be disagreeing about. and it is the most important thing out there, than someone who says, boy, if we emphasize God's grace and Christ's work for people too much, and if we tell them too much that Jesus did it all, we're going to end up with fat, lazy Christians. So we need to put less emphasis. You see, it's not that big of a deal. What Jesus did at the cross is a deal, but it's not that big of a deal. And if you make it too big of a deal, you can overemphasize. If you make it too big of a deal, you know, you're going to end up with baby Christians rather than grown-up Christians. Now, there's an example of someone who may well understand what justification is, but they somehow think too much of a good thing can hurt someone. Too much of the good news is going to hurt someone. Too much good news is going to hurt them. We've got to give them more bad news. Of course, the problem is they don't think the bad news they're giving is bad. They just think it's another good news. Or as Paul might put it, another gospel. Come on, it's not bad. It's another gospel. It's the alternate gospel. Mark is calling from his car. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Pastor. When you were saying that, you know, we are more concerned about prayer in school or God in the Pledge of Allegiance than we are about the gospel, both in the church and outside the church, I totally agree with that. In fact, I may be swerving over to the other side too far and into the ditch, in that I don't know that we're supposed to be doing what we're doing as far as trying to apply the law to the culture, other than just on an individual basis to point out sin and then give the good news.
Well, let me see if I can speak to that, Mark. You're right to be wary of falling off into the ditch on the other side. You're right to be wary of that, because nowhere are Christians counseled to be quietistic in the world. Nowhere there to be the thorn in the world's side. That's what Christians are to be. That's what Jesus means when he says light and salt. You are the thorn in the world's side. You're going to be considered the biggest troublemakers, but you can't back down. Now, the question is, how do we approach the culture? Are we right to be concerned about, say, the scrubbing of God from the public square? Yes, we are right to be concerned about it. But there are two things Christians need to remember. Number one, the way to approach that issue is not by yanking out your Bible and saying, we expect the state to preach about our God, even if it's in our pledge or in our schools, or to be praying to our God in our schools. No, the way to do that is to say, look, there may be some benefits to having prayer or quiet time in a school, but we certainly don't want the schools telling our kids who that God is. They're going to get it wrong every time. And the other thing is this. When we do have that voice in the public square, when we do bring God into this conversation in the public square, let's make sure it's not just G-O-D, generic old God. Let's make sure that we're specific, because we have a specific God, and he's done specific things, like send his son Jesus Christ to be the savior of sinners. If we're not in the public square with that message, we're not salt and we're not light, period. We'll be right back to talk with Greg Kokel.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do Christians, Jews, and Muslims worship the same God? Can someone worship God the Father apart from Jesus Christ? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. I've written an article for the next edition of the Issues Etc. Journal. It's called Mere Monotheism, and you can receive a complimentary copy of the Issues Etc. Journal by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. What's the difference between a knowledge of God and the true worship of God? Find out with the Issues Etc. Journal, 1-800-737-0172. The next issue also details Dr. Leonard Peyton's journey from Calvinism to Lutheranism, 1-800-737-0172. Now, if you enjoy Issues Etc., the radio show, you need to get the Issues Etc. Journal. Call now, 1-800-737-0172, and ask for a free copy of the Issues Etc. Journal.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Stuart Shepherd. Does your cable package include channels you wish were not even coming into your house? Some are arguing that you should be given the power to select only the channels you want, freeing you from paying for those you would never voluntarily support. A House subcommittee heard testimony on that proposition, and our Capitol Hill correspondent Keith Peters was there.
The hearing focused on the idea of a la carte programming, letting the consumer decide which cable channels they want for their money and blocking all the other channels. Congressman Fred Upton says he opposes a mandated a la carte cable offering.
I believe that an a la carte system would result in higher prices to the consumer and cause families to pay more to get the channels that they do want than if they just blocked for free the channels they did not want.
But Congressman Nathan Deal of Georgia is angry that broadcasting conglomerates are forcing objectionable programming on families that don't want it.
We should have them explain to us why the American public, why a family that wants to buy a cartoon program, Nicktoons, should be forced to also buy the program logo, a gay and lesbian channel.
Jan LaRue of Concerned Women for America urged the committee to let Americans choose what they want in their homes.
Let's let the American people decide if they're willing, if necessary, to pay a little more for the programs they want rather than paying the higher and higher cable bills they are paying for programming, most of which they don't want.
She says a la carte programming would give consumers complete control over what comes into their homes and would help them control their cable bills. For Family News in Focus, I'm Keith Peters in Washington.
A poll released by Concerned Women for America in May revealed that 80% of Americans say cable customers should not be required to pay for extra channels that they do not want to view. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepherd.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO, join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers. We'll talk with Francine Huff, news editor for Wall Street Journal. She's also worked for the Boston Globe and the Pittsburgh Press. She's author of The 25-Day Financial Makeover to help women get serious about their financial situation in less than a month. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee on AM 850 KFUO.
Was fascism defeated in World War II, or is it alive and well today? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for July is Modern Fascism by Dr. Jean Edward Veith. You can find out more about this book on our website, issuesetc.org. Just click the What's New section, or by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $17.99 plus shipping and handling. Modern Fascism, our book of the month.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Greg Kokel is with us for the next hour of the program, From Stand to Reason. We're going to be talking with him about hate crimes and hate speech. Now, this is something that's been in the news because of Canada's laws. We'll talk a bit about that, that have come out about homosexuality and what people say in public and private about homosexuality. And also, we'll talk a little bit about the Matthew Shepard case, that famous case of the beating and the killing of a 22-year-old Colorado man, apparently because he was gay. It sparked the national debate over hate crimes. Now, what is a hate crime, and what is hate crime legislation? It's an odd way of putting it, but we're going to get a good definition and find out why, while Greg is against hate crime legislation, he's also against hate crimes, too, here during this hour of Issues, etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Greg Kokel is president of Stand to Reason, and he has also written in a recent Solid Ground newsletter about hate crimes and hate speech. Greg, welcome back to Issues Etc.
How are you doing, Todd?
Doing very well.
Good.
Greg, I don't know where you stand on the federal marriage amendment, but...
I bet you could guess.
Well, we'll find out here. The U.S. Senate just wrapped up debate on this issue.
Right.
And I wanted your reaction to something that Senator Barbara Boxer of California had to say on this, and react to her general argument here. Here's Barbara Boxer.
This constitutional amendment is an attempt to appeal to our prejudice instead of to our compassion, to our hatreds instead of to our hopes, to our fears instead of our dreams. The constitutional amendment is an appeal to what is worse than us instead of what is best in us.
Greg, what is her argument and how do you respond to it?
Well, basically, to answer your question, what is her argument? She's saying that this amendment should be opposed because of the malicious attitudes of the people that have raised the amendment. It's an attempt, as she put it, to appeal to prejudice, fear, and hatred, I think were her words, instead of compassion, hope, and something with a D. I was writing quickly here, but and to our dreams, I guess. And, well, she's just, you know, I'm really, in one sense, I'm very surprised that people who have opposed this, at least the attempt to let the people discuss this and have their say on this issue, how they are so incapable of hearing the case that is being presented. Now, they're too smart for that. They know the case, but they don't want to argue the merits. They would rather just disparage those that are offering it. This is a classical ad hominem. It's an attack on the people rather than dealing with the idea. Even if it were an attempt motivated by prejudice, fear, and hatred, it doesn't mean that it's a bad enterprise. And some things that are motivated by compassion, hope, and our deepest, fondest dreams turn out to be bad legislation. The point here should be to look at not the alleged, I'm not even buying that her assessment's correct here, but let's just, even if it were, the point is not to look at the alleged motivations of the people promoting this, but at the bill itself, for goodness sake. And the reasons, at least they put forward, for wanting to discuss this issue. I heard something yesterday that was very similar in Los Angeles here, where I live, on by a fairly somewhat conservative talk show host, who was, however, a lesbian. And she was upset about this, and because she said that it's this is about it's motivated by religion, and there is no place for religious motivations to be involved in a constitutional discussion. Of course, nothing in our laws or constitution disqualifies any point of view because of the motivations that push that view forward. The government should be unconcerned about our motivations. What they should be concerned about are our actions, our ideas, and our arguments. Excuse me, and these are the kinds of things, the arguments in particular for the Sanctity of Marriage Amendment, Barbara Boxer is not willing to engage. If she was willing to engage it, she would engage it. She's not willing to engage it. She'd rather call names of her opponents, like she did, to substitute for good argument. Now, it may turn out that her point of view is a good one and a correct one. I don't think so, but it may turn out that way. But we can never know that based on what she said. It may turn out that our point of view in favor of the amendment is a bad one and shouldn't be followed. But we can never know that by the content of her remarks. Therefore, we have once again a U.S. senator that has failed to lead in a reasonable fashion, but instead has led with the same things. Her conduct actually does represent the same things that she's accusing her opposition of doing, and that is promoting prejudice, fear, and hatred. That's all she's done is to name call and act as if name calling of the other side is a reasonable and appropriate way of dealing with these kinds of issues. It's simply not.
What about the statement that to forbid gay marriage to homosexuals is in and of itself discriminatory? How do you respond to that?
Well, this is a tricky one, and this is actually we've discussed this before, and a lot depends on what you mean by discrimination. I'm spending my hour here with you instead of with somebody, my next door neighbor, you know, chatting about crabgrass. But that's a type of discrimination, but it's certainly not actionable because I'm within my rights to make these kinds of choices. The real question isn't whether it's a discrimination, but whether the discrimination is based on differences that are relevant to the circumstance. When a man goes in to get a medical procedure that a woman is allowed to have and a man is not allowed to have, it is fair to call that a discrimination. But it's not a relevant civil rights concern if the discrimination is the woman gets to have a hysterectomy and the man doesn't. That is, there is a relevant difference between a man and a woman on the issue at question that makes the charge of illicit discrimination inappropriate. Now, the question is, then, is that kind of charge appropriate here? Certainly there is a discrimination. Heterosexual couples get a privilege from the culture/government that homosexual couples don't get. yes, there's a discrimination, but is it appropriate? And you can only know that by asking the question, why do heterosexual couples get this privilege? And heterosexual couples from the beginning of time, I don't care if you spin this in a theistic creationist sense or in a naturalistic evolution sense, no matter how you cut it, from the beginning of time, in every society, at every period of history, every single culture has always privileged a heterosexual long-term monogamous relationship. The question is, why have they done that? The answer isn't because all these cultures hated homosexuals. The answer is that heterosexual relationships as a group and as a rule give culture something that homosexual relationships don't give it, the next generation. And because the government and culture is concerned with the safety of the next generation, this peculiar relationship, which as a rule and as a group produces the next generation, gets both the protection, privilege, and the sanctions, in other words, protective legislation and limitations from the government in order to protect the next generation. Homosexuals just don't, as a rule and as a group, produce the next generation, so they are not under the same concern that heterosexual relationships are. Therefore, though there is discrimination, there is not illicit or inappropriate discrimination that really amounts to a civil rights violation.
Let's talk about hate crimes for a moment, if we could.
These are related, actually.
They certainly are. Now, you write early on in one of your articles in the Solid Ground newsletter about this harrowing case of Matthew Shepard in Fort Collins, Colorado, died after being, well, it looks like the two perpetrators did just about everything they possibly could do to him, including leaving him exposed in winter weather, having been beaten nearly to death. He did eventually die.
Yeah, a couple days after he was found, he died. He was strung up on a fence after having his skull smashed with a handgun, been beaten by fists. His face and his hands were cut. His body was burned, strung up on a fence, exposed overnight to 30-degree temperatures. And a few days later, at Fort Collins, Colorado, Matthew Shepard did die. It was terrible. In fact, this is the initiation that most of the country, and probably most of your listeners, certainly myself, had to hate crimes. And we all shudder when we read the account.
Now, you say you are against hate crimes, but the legislation that got rolling after the Matthew Shepard case became a national story that calls for hate crime legislation, you're against hate crime legislation.
Right.
What do you mean?
Well, there's an underlying principle here, Todd, and that is that not everything wrong should be illegal. There are all kinds of things that we consider wrong, but if it turns out that each of those things that we consider wrong were actually actionable, it would create the most oppressive society imaginable. And so we are, for the principle of liberty, we are willing to put up with certain types of wrong actions and maybe put peer pressure regarding those things, but we don't punish them by rule of law. And so, frankly, where that line is drawn is the political problem. This is exactly what politics is about. Where do we draw the line between passing a law, there ought to be a law, and punishing people, and not doing that, and how, you know, maintaining liberty. And so that's really the core of the political problem. Now, in this particular case, we have the same thing. Should brutal beatings be illegal? Yes, they are, and they're actionable, and they should be, and we should punish those people to the full extent of the law. And if the punishments are not enough for the nature of the conduct itself, then those punishments should be increased. However, hate crime legislation is not legislation that is directed at conduct. The conduct is already actionable, Todd. It's already punishable. It is an additional punishment that is levied against the thoughts of the person who committed the actionable crime. It's a thought crime. And thought, listen carefully, thought crimes require thought police. The reason that this hate crime legislation is so nefarious is one of them, and I actually talk about three of them in the piece, Why Hate Shouldn't Be a Crime. One of them is that that it criminalizes a mental state. It criminalizes an attitude. It criminalizes a motive. It criminalizes a thought. And we have never done that before, nor should we, because you cannot know what a person's thoughts are. You might be able to infer it from some evidence. The fact is, if somebody commits a brutal crime, they get punished. If somebody commits a brutal crime and they just simply use a racial epithet, they will be then charged with a hate crime. Not for saying that thing, but because the racial epithet seems to indicate the person had malice towards the race of the person who they assaulted, and therefore an additional penalty is leveled for the attitude of malice. And boy, that opens a Pandora's box that is harrowing to consider.
Does the state have any legitimate interest in motive for crimes per se when it comes to punishing? I mean, they obviously have an interest in motive when they're investigating crimes.
Well, the goal...
I mean, it's going to lead them in the right direction, but when it comes to actual punishments that they hand out...
No, well, the word interest is a little bit of a slippery word. It is actually, it isn't even interest in the case of motive. What it is they try to infer motive to determine whether the conduct was that person's or somebody else's. Who killed the man? Well, I don't know. Let's see who has a motive. Notice even in that case, it's not the motive that's being punished. The motive that they can infer is just an indicator of who might have done the job. They're interested in punishing the action. Do they have an interest in having people have good thoughts and pleasant attitudes towards people? Of course they have an interest in that. The question is, what's the right way to promote that interest? Punishing what they think are bad thoughts is not the right way, is the point I'm making. There are other means to do that. That's called moral education. And there are a whole lot of things that they could be doing right now to that end that they're simply not doing. This isn't the right way to do it, to punish people for having the wrong thoughts.
Now, before we go on too much farther into the other things that are wrong with hate crimes legislation, it seems that there's a problem with the word hate here.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to assume that, let's say for the sake of argument, a man kills another man, a heterosexual kills a homosexual.
Mm-hmm.
He does it, and it's widely known by the community that he believes homosexuality to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
He's never expressed any animus towards homosexuals. He just believes homosexuality is wrong. Now, if that's brought into a court of law, he'd probably maybe be convicted of a hate crime. Does he actually hate?
Well, see, that's the question. How do you know? It's one thing to measure an action. By the way, it's hard enough to figure out whether a person did something wrong. I mean, that's plenty burdensome to prove that guy did the thing. He committed the crime. Can you imagine how much more difficult it is to try to figure out what was motivating that person, what he was thinking, what was his attitude at the moment that he did? Now, to some degree, we do have to do that. We mentioned motive as an indicator of guilt for the action itself. We also take, the irony here is that we take motive into consideration not to increase the punishment of a crime, but to decrease it. That is, crimes of passion, second-degree murder as opposed to lying in wait, you know, and planning the crime. Crimes of passion are considered more, dealt with more leniently because we figure that if a person is driven by passion, that's a mitigating factor. Even if you could figure out whether the person was motivated by hate, and I think your point is it's really hard to do that, how do you know? Maybe you don't. Maybe he thought homosexuality was wrong, and he killed this homosexual for some reason unrelated to the homosexuality. It doesn't matter, because if they knew he didn't like homosexuals, they're going to put the two and two together, and then he's going to be, watch this, punished for a crime he didn't commit. And, of course, the crime I'm thinking of here is the hate crime. But because you have this protected class of people, homosexuals protected by and sexual preference by hate crime legislation, this person is going to be punished. It may be that he never hated this person at all. But even if he did, usually in the law, that's considered a mitigating factor, a reason to lessen the punishment, not to increase it, for goodness sake, because people overcome by passion do things that people who are thinking straight wouldn't normally do. And the greatest approbation and the greatest punishment is for the cold-blooded killer who lies in wait and plans the deed. Yet under these circumstances, in the logic of hate crime legislation, that person turns out to be more noble. the one that can kill without thinking, that can just wipe somebody out, that can plan it out in a cold-blooded way and kill it, that person turns out to be less punishable than the person who, in a fit of rage, not only uses language he might not use with regards to a person and calling them a racial name, but would also use his conduct he wouldn't normally use, and that is to assault that person. Now we got two crimes instead of one.
Greg Kokel is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc., and we're talking about hate crimes and hate speech with Greg Kokel. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Greg, tell us about the law that was recently passed in California by the parliament there.
California is not yet a separate country, though it seems like it sometimes.
Yes. In Canada, that has to do with these very issues.
Well, sometimes when I talk like I've been talking with you here today, people think, oh, come on, Coco, that's just the slippery slope. You know, you're Chicken Little, the sky is falling, and you're exaggerating things. The fact is, I'm not, and just north of our border in Canada, a country that in many ways is very much like ours, though I would say a bit more liberal, still very much like California, though, in April, by a vote of 59-11, passed C-250 in the Canadian Parliament, which is a bill that criminalizes the expression of hate for homosexuality. In other words, it is not just a bill that criminalizes the attitude of hate in the process of committing another crime. It actually criminalizes the expression of what they call hate for homosexuality. And here's the part of the text. Everyone who, by communicating statements, so we're talking about speech here, other than in private conversation, of course, there's a fudge word, what is private, willfully promotes hatred against any identifiable group is guilty of an indictable offense and is liable to imprisonment for a term not exceeding 2 years. So the question is, or the prohibition here is, prison punishment up to 2 years for doing what? For saying things in, scare quotes here, public, whatever that is, that, scare quotes again, willfully promotes hatred against any identifiable group. What the heck is willfully promoting hatred? What is public? It seems increasingly like, and certainly this is clearly the intent of those people who put the bill on the floor, Sven Robinson, for example, who wants to criminalize any anti-homosexual speech itself, regardless if it's characterized as hateful or not. This is a law that's actionable with 2 years imprisonment just north of our border for talking hatefully about homosexuals. Now, what does talking hatefully entail? Well, even before the law was passed, and I'm quoting here from World Magazine, at least one Saskatchewan court had already held that certain Bible passages expose homosexuals to hatred, that in London, Ontario, officials slapped a Christian mayor with a $10,000 fine for refusing to proclaim Gay Pride Day, and a Christian businessman in Toronto was fined $5,000 for refusing to print materials for a gay rights group. So that's the momentum going into the passage now of this law, and it looks very much like Christians will not even, pastors in their congregations, as a matter of law now, will not be able to teach that homosexuality is immoral because it will be characterized as a public statement that's stirring up hate. That's what happens when hate becomes a crime, when the attitude becomes a crime. Pretty soon now there are methods to measure the attitude. Oh, now it's what you say. Now you better be darn careful because your mouth can get you in big trouble, might indicate the nasty attitudes that you have. And that's what we're talking about.
It seems as though that that Canada law is now saying it's not just your motive, it's what kind of motives you might possibly stir with your words among others that is considered to be the crime.
That's right. If they look at your language and it looks like, let's see, willfully promoting hatred. So in this case, they've got to make the case that you are trying to promote hatred. But you know how this is working. Even in, you know, around the country, even more conservative states than California, the mere expression of one's alternate point of view is taken as an expression of hate. How do I know that? Because Barbara Boxer said it today, a U.S. senator. These people are incapable of seeing that there might be some people in the world that have principled objections against this. All they are capable of seeing, it seems, at least in their public comment, is prejudice, fear, and, by the way, hatred was one of her words in the piece that you just played for us. That's all they're capable of seeing. So when you oppose in the public homosexuality, regardless of how principled your view is, it is characterized by the other side as prejudice, fear, and hatred. And if hatred for homosexuals is illegal, when you start expressing your views against homosexuality, you are guilty of violating any laws that make it illegal to hate.
With less than 1 minute, and the final question on that Canada law, if the identifiable group were Christians, and if the public speech inciting hatred were, say, a gay activist who was bashing Christians in a public protest on the streets of Toronto, would this law be applied in Canada?
You know, that is a very good question. And it says hatred against any identifiable group. It strikes me that this law itself would qualify as hatred against any identifiable group if it's going to take action against Christians for speaking their conscience on this particular issue. I don't know if it turned out to be a homosexual saying that under these circumstances. We'll just have to see. But that's a darn good question, and it occurred to me, too.
Greg Kokel is our guest, president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California, author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. He's also written an article in the latest Solid Ground newsletter titled Why Hate Shouldn't Be a Crime. You can read this article on the web. Simply go first to our website, issuesetc.org, under the section titled Links with Regular Guests. You'll find a direct link to Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason. Or, if you'd like to receive their free Solid Ground newsletter, call Stand to Reason. Their toll-free number, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. When we come back, those words, any identifiable group, leads us to the next objection that Greg has to hate crime legislation. It used to be, in law, that you had to actually commit a crime, take action against an individual. Well, now, there doesn't have to be an individual in view. You can say something directed at no one in particular, perhaps, if you're in Canada, and it's considered a hate crime because you have spoken against the group. We'll talk about that nature of hate crime legislation when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.